Es gibt so einen berühmten medienkritischen Satz, der seit vielen Jahren, wenn nicht sogar seit Jahrzehnten, durchs Internet und durch meinen Kopf geistert. Und der geht so. Jede Überschrift, die mit einem Fragezeichen endet, kann mit einem Nein beantwortet werden. Ursprünglich formuliert worden ist dieser Satz vom britischen Journalisten Ian Battridge. Heißt darum Battridges Gesetz der Überschriften oder halt auf Englisch Battridges Law of Headlines. Any headline that ends in a question mark can be answered by the word no. Ian Battridge, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Who are you?
Oh, that's a very good question. In some
way you're famous.
Well, yeah, by accident more than design, I think. So I have been a journalist for 30 years now. 31, in fact, in January. And I started working on technology magazines back when there were such things as magazines. And my first magazine was a magazine called Mac User, which was all about Apple and the Macintosh before the iPhone. So, you know, the Mac was Apple's only product, basically, at that point. And I worked on that for 8 years, ended up editing it. I've done other things as well, like content marketing. I've done audience development, so SEO, social media management, all that kind of stuff. I had a long and long varied career, but weirdly, I am most famous for an off-the-cuff blog post that I did in about, I think, 2007, where it was literally, I think, two paragraphs long, so nothing kind of like in-depth or anything like that, where I just said that something along the lines of Betteridge's law of headlines, any headline ending in a question mark can always be answered with the word no. And somehow, and I swear by all that's holy that I didn't do this, this ended up on Wikipedia as Betteridge's law of headlines, and it became cemented as this. So now I've been told it's taught in journalism schools, which, given that I didn't even go to journalism school, is a bit of a surprise to me.
Maybe this says something about journalism itself. Do you remember in what situation you came up with this law? Is it a law? It's more a proverb, is it?
It's technically, I think it's an adage. So it's entirely correct. So, you know, there are exceptions to it. How did I come up with it? I had an editor prior to that, when I think I was doing news writing a lot, who was very set against ending headlines with a question mark. She always said that basically, if you know what the answer is, you should say that in the headline. If you don't know what the answer is, why are you even writing a story about it? So question marks in headlines just meant that actually, you know, you didn't know the answer to the question, and we were journalists. We were paid to find out the answers for our audience. So she was dead set against it. And that kind of stuck with me. And I just, you know, in a comedy moment, decided to name it after myself.
So it's not some specific article you're referring to. It's just your work experience.
The blog post itself was referring to a specific article, and I can't remember for the life of me which one. It almost doesn't matter. But, you know, it was a period in time when there was a lot of kind of first generation online journalism around. Mm. So people who had started in online rather than starting in print, as I did. And so they'd learned a whole different set of rules to the rules that I'd kind of been trained on. And one of those rules was you often ended a headline with a question mark because it's a bit of a tease. You know, yeah. It kind of gets the audience to click because people naturally want to find out what the answers are to a question. So you see a question like, is Apple bringing out a 15-inch iPhone this week? Then everyone's going to click on that. Whereas if you say, Apple is not bringing out a 15-inch iPhone this week, then that's not really anything to write home about. So different set of rules, basically. And so there was a lot of sites kind of started using headlines and question marks because on social media it worked really well. And so I was sort of pushing back against that a little bit.
So in the digital world, your law would be more true than in the printed world?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think there is a lot more of a race to kind of publish stuff which is unsubstantiated, where you haven't necessarily got two sources to it, which was kind of what I was taught you had to do for a genuine news story. So I think in that case, you know, when you're online, it's really, really fast. You have to kind of get something up really quickly. So even if you're not sure, you're better to kind of jump in with a, is this actually happening? We don't know, but there is some evidence there might be kind of story, rather than a, you know, fully fledged one that might take you weeks to actually kind of confirm.
Do you keep track of articles that confirm your law?
No.
No? Well, you could automate it.
I think that would be a full-time job. but it is very, very common now. And it's got to the point now where I look at those kind of headlines and I actually wonder, is this deliberate? You know, is the person who wrote this actually, it's a story which is saying, no, this isn't correct. Because it's kind of like, you know, they want to say the opposite and this is quite a good way of doing it. So I kind of wonder whether it's influenced people to use more question marks where they actually know that the answer is already no.
Did you ever ask?
Not yet. No, I should do though. The only time I've ever had some pushback from a journalist about it, and I'm not going to name names because that wouldn't be fair because they might have changed their mind by now. It's quite a few years ago. Was a journalist on a tech site who, because he knew that it was, you know, they would knowingly use it in order to drive clicks, he got really quite mad about this whole kind of thing of people pointing out that, you know, they could answer it with a no without reading. So it was kind of, that was quite, yeah, he was a bit frosty about the whole thing. But, you know, it's just become a thing now that I think I see so many examples of, and people send them to me all the time. So my social media is basically one long stream of people tagging me in to question mark headlines now.
I'm sorry, I was one of them.
That's okay. I'll forgive you.
I don't know if your law is true. There has been a study that denies your proposal, but at least in German news media, it does feel true. Is it maybe country specific, language specific?
I don't think it's country or language specific. I mean, I guess it's down to what the journalism culture is more than anything else. So, you know, if it's, and also now whether it's used knowingly or not. I think it was always true because when you think about it, you know, what makes it true is that if you have got a story which confirms something, and you've got all the confirmation you need, why frame it as a headline with a question mark on it? So, I mean, for example, if I found out tomorrow that, I don't know, there was a solid link proving that Donald Trump was fantastic friends with Jeffrey Epstein and, you know, was involved in all of Epstein's stuff, I wouldn't add a question mark to that headline. I'd just be going, Trump linked to Epstein, conclusive proof, or something like that. You know, so if you've got a strong story, assert it. And I think that's why it works most of the time is, you know, if you've got a strong story, you're going to say it in the headline because you want everybody to really click on it. When it's just a maybe it is, maybe it isn't story, then, you know, you might use a question mark for it. And 9 times out of 10, if you're not certain that it's a good enough story to just be assertive about the headline, then it's probably not actually true.
So that's the socio-technical side of the thing. On your website, I found a sentence that goes, "One day I'll write up what it's like to be best known for something that was intended as a throwaway remark." What's it like?
Well,
How were your last 20 years?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because there have been times when I've thought, oh, God, you know, all I've ever done in my life is this, you know, this one blog post, which kind of took off. But now I've got to the point where I'm kind of quite proud of it because I think, you know, it sounds ridiculous to say it, but one of the things that I think people need to be literate about is how the media works. And I kind of think this is a tiny little contribution towards that because it makes people stop and think about the relationship between headlines and stories. And that's a really, really important thing in journalism generally. You know, the way that you write headlines is to get people to read the story more than anything else. And once you start to understand that, you understand why headlines are often, even when they're not, you know, questions, why they are the way they are, and why they are really oriented towards kind of getting you to read the story or click on the article or get Google to rank it now as well, rather than just being a straight reflection of the actual story itself. It deliberately, you always deliberately pick out the line which is going to get people to read.
How long did it take you to come to peace with this whole story?
Well, you know, I think it's... not long, to be honest. It's a bit like...
So it's more a blessing than a curse.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I'm pleased that people find it interesting. I'm pleased that people find it funny. I am genuinely pleased when people send me examples of it because, you know, sometimes I get to say I'm giving it a pass because I'd like the answer to be yes rather than no. I think it's like, you know, it's a papal indulgence. I reckon that I can give people passes.
When people talk to you, when people get to know you and they hear your name, do they usually know who they're talking to?
Every now and then, yes. Happens more online than off, but it has happened offline as well when I've met somebody. Quite a lot there is, I get quite a lot of people saying, oh, I thought you must be dead, because they think this is something that's been around for, you know, 100 years or something like that.
It really feels like that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's weird. but apart from that, yeah, I mean, I do, you know, I've met a lot of people through it. And that, again, that's kind of a blessing, isn't it? You know, even if it's a one-off interaction and it's made somebody's day, you know, at the end of the day, it's kind of like, if that makes somebody's day, brilliant, why not?
Do they buy you drinks?
I've only ever been bought a drink on one occasion, I think. I'd like that to be more. So if anybody's out there and you ever encounter me in real life, perfectly happy to accept a drink.
In our times, internet fame is something one could quite easily can cash in on. Mm. Did that work somehow for you? Did you ever try?
Never made a penny. And to be honest, I don't think I would want to. You know, I think one time somebody asked me if I was interested in writing a book about it. And I just thought, well... You know, it originated with a blog post that was two paragraphs long. How the heck would you write a book about it?
Ask 90% of the people writing books.
Well, true, actually, yeah. I mean, the number of books that I bought, especially kind of self-help books that promise to change your life, and they've got one piece of advice in them that just goes on and on, rewritten throughout the whole, you know, 40,000 words or so. So it can be done. But no, I've never really thought about making money from it. It was just a thing. It was fun. And I think it's also, you know, one of the things that I always think about with it is it's a demonstration of how the earlier you were on the internet, the easier it is for something like this to occur. So, you know, Mike Godwin, who did Godwin's Law, was also very, very early Internet guy.
Godwin was, je länger eine Diskussion dauert, desto größer die Wahrscheinlichkeit, dass irgendwann ein Nazi-Vergleich oder ein Hitler-Vergleich kommt. The longer a discussion online goes on, the greater the chance that any Hitler comparison will show
yes.
up.
and funny enough, Mike was on The Well, which is a very, very early internet community. And I was on The Well around the sort of mid-90s as well. So we sort of vaguely kind of know each other's names, at least. And I think there is something to that. You know, the earlier you are on the internet, the more opportunity there was to sort of plant a seed of something for the internet to take it and grow with it and make it something much bigger than you ever intended it to be. So, you know, I think that that kind of early internet culture has kind of amplified a lot of things like that.
Do you think this would be possible today?
I think it'd be much harder today. I think, in a sense, there are ways in which it might be easier because there are, you know, established routes to viral fame, which, you know, was not the case 15, 20 years ago. But on the other hand, there are a lot more people competing for attention now. And while I wasn't particularly looking for attention, it's definitely a thing that people are really super focused on. You know, if my blog back in the day got 50 people reading something, that was kind of big. So,
You didn't plan for this.
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, it must be 2010 or 2011. The blog that I posted this on actually basically disappeared from the internet.
Why?
Well, I was running WordPress and the database got corrupted and there was a backup, but I just couldn't be bothered to fix it. So effectively, the original post was wiped from the internet for a while, but thankfully it was in the Wayback Machine, so people find it through that. And because it was already on Wikipedia at that point, I think, they had obviously linked to the archive version. And so it kind of got a life from there. But I just didn't really think about it as anything valuable. I didn't think about any of those kind of early blog posts as anything that was worth the hour or two it would have taken me to fix that database. I've sometimes thought about trying to resurrect that database now, because I'm sure I've still got a copy, because I am a bit of an info hoarder. I've got hard drives kicking around that have had stuff on them since 1990, in fact. And, so it's kind of, would I want to resurrect it now? I think I quite like the mystery that it's this bit of the internet. It's also sort of disappeared, and you get echoes of it in the Wayback Machine and on Wikipedia as well.
So in the end, only good came from this story.
Yeah. And nothing. And I think that's kind of...
it's how the internet was intended.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It was, you know, the internet was all about connecting people, really. And it was fundamentally about being able to share things that, you know, were interesting or helped people or made your day, or, you know, everything going back to the kind of coffee cam at Oxford. One of the very, very first webcams pointed at the coffee pot in, I think, the computer science study area, so that everybody knew, could like just look at it and check whether there was coffee left, and they knew whether to go for a coffee or not. But all those kind of things... the internet is very changed now. Obviously, you've got the domination of platforms whose measure of success for themselves is all about engagement. They get a lot of engagement out of things which are, either not true or corrosive, really. And so it's a very different kind of internet now to what it was 20 years ago. That's not to say that, you know, the internet then was perfect, because you have to remember that, like, my generation involved trolling. Basically, we invented that as well as internet laws. You know?
I remember vicious flame wars on Usenet.
Oh,
yes,
man, they were hilarious fun. And that's the thing; it was a very different kind of place, because also some of those flame wars were just fun. You know, it was kind of winding people up for fun rather than winding them up because actually you want them to vote for racists, and, you know, different world, very different world.
Do we ever get that back?
Personally, I think the genie is out of the bottle, and so it will be very, very difficult for the bulk of the internet to become, it sounds cliche to say it, become a kinder, more sharing place. But I think there are kind of seeds of, some of the same kind of attitudes emerging. I'm really hopeful for the kind of the youngest generation of internet users, because I think they've grown up with the stress of social media, and it's interesting seeing how they perceive the internet differently. They're aware it can be a bad thing as well as a good thing, in a way that, you know, maybe earlier generations weren't. So that's good. I've seen a lot of a lot of kind of help given across different kinds of communities. You know, if you think of Mastodon, for example, I don't think I've ever seen a flame war like play out on Mastodon.
I tried to start a few, but it didn't work.
Just kind of peter out, you know, whereas I've seen a lot of people kind of being helpful. And I'll give you a really good example of that, actually. So like most people of my age, I'm not always aware when I say something and it is potentially offensive. So a few, it must be a couple of years ago now, I called somebody a crank. Not somebody online, somebody, you know. And somebody in the disabled community very gently said to me, you really shouldn't use that word. And, you know, it would be very, very easy for me or for anyone to just go, ah, for God's sake, don't be stupid. It's just a word. Da, 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 da. How can it be offended? Da, 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 da. But what I actually did was I DM'd them and said, I'm really sorry. Can you explain to me why, what the offense comes from? And they explained to me. And I think that's kind of the step change in some ways. It's if you are prepared to listen and to understand, then I think actually most people are much kinder to you in spaces like Mastodon. So I think there is a bit more forgiveness, and I think that goes a long way.
There's a better place emerging somehow, but it takes time.
Yeah, I think that there is a growing awareness that the internet that we have now has been constructed by people who were doing it very much for economic gain. You know, at the end of the day, the kind of profit motive pushes them into a particular kind of design for what we do in terms of platform. Mastodon isn't like that. It's not created for anyone's economic gain. It began as a fun thing, began as a bit of a project, you know, a hobby. And now it's got a really good feeling around it. You know, that's not to say every server is kind of positive and upbeat. Quite a few of them are not, but that's why you have server blocks, right? So it's kind of, it can be a different space, and it's created by the people who make it rather than created by a corporation for its own reasons and its own kind of rationale. And I think we'll see a lot more of those emerge gradually over time, but it's not quick. You know, there's no quick answers to any of this. And quick answers tend to come from people who have a lot of who want to be able to control stuff. You know, we could appoint an internet emperor who wouldn't allow things that we didn't agree with and wanted a nicer internet. But when you've got that kind of absolute power, there's that old phrase, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the same would be true if we had that kind of almost dictatorial internet. So it's got to happen organically. It's got to happen because people want it to happen.
But at least there's one quick answer, and it's to the question, can any headline that ends in a question mark be answered by the word no?
100% no.
Ian Bettridge, thank you very much.
You're welcome, anytime.
Wer redet, ist nicht tot.